The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting live from our studio in New York City. This is the Progressive Radio Network, the meeting place for independent and progressive-minded individuals. For the next 2 hours, we will be exploring from a different perspective the results of the election. We will not be looking at it as Republicans, as Green Party, as Democrats, or incumbents. Instead, we will be asking more probing questions than I've been watching for the last couple of hours on either Fox or CNN or MSNBC. My guest during this next 2 hours will be Danny Schachter. These are all hosts of programs on the Progressive Radio Network. Danny Schachter is called the News Dissector. He's a television Emmy Award-winning producer, an award-winning filmmaker of outstanding documentaries, a journalist, a media critic, an economist, and he's with us now. He also is a graduate of the London School of Economics and has been a fellow at Harvard University and a professor at Columbia University School of Journalism. He will be joined by the Freedom Hour host, Walt Thiessen, and he is a graduate of Colgate University, and he is a person who was a former liberal who has now moved towards the progressive libertarian camp. We'll have an insight on what does it mean to be that, and how does this election bode for them, and what does he see as the solutions. We will also be joined in this hour by Norman Solomon. He is a political columnist. He is a founding president of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a national consortium of policy researchers and analysts, and his writings earned him the George Orwell Award for Distinguished Contributions to Honesty and Clarity. He authored 10 books dealing with Iraq, America's Culture of War, Critiques on Mainstream Media and Atomic Radiation. And also in this hour, we'll be joined by John Rappaport. He is an internationally known investigative reporter. His articles on politics, science, and environmental issues have appeared in LA Weekly, Environmental Action, In These Times, and many others. We will also be joined by David Swanson. He is one of our most important social and political activists in the liberal progressive movement. He was Dennis Kucinich's press secretary, and he is the author of Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. Now, that's just in this hour. In the next hour, we will have Black Agenda Reports' Glenn Ford. He has been a journalist and political activist and for over 40 years. And he was a newsman for James Brown's radio station in Augusta, Georgia. And he created the first syndicated black radio news magazine, Black World Report. And the first, that was 1971, and the first syndicated black news interview program on commercial television, Black America's Black Forum. And he has served as a White House, Capitol Hill, and State Department correspondent and a Washington bureau chief for the Mutual Black Network. And he will have a perspective. And we'll be rounding out the hour with Christiane Brown, who many of you have heard on Air America. And she hosts the Solution Zone, and we will get a perspective on her. She's had conversations with Barack Obama, Harry Reid, Joe Biden on war, torture, impeachment, warrantless wiretapping, and the abuse of power, and how all these are dealt with. Well, in point of fact, none of them have been dealt with in this campaign, and we're going to talk about that. I will be, time permitting, I will be doing some commentaries on how the future will judge our moral failings by Anthony Appai, The Anti-Anti-Authoritarians by Sheldon Richman, Crisis is an Opportunity, Engineering the Global Depression to Create a Global Government by Andrew Marshall, and then looking at the things we do not want to talk about in any of the campaigns. The United Nations environmental chief says that we are destroying life on Earth. It is costing $6 trillion a year. And yet, as of today, virtually nothing has been done that would hold any government or any group of people or any corporation to actual standards of performance. It's all voluntary. And also we'll talk about digging in for the long haul in Haiti, how permanent are America's Afghan bases, and why none of this is being discussed in this election cycle, or likely to be discussed when the Republicans take the House tomorrow. Let's begin by saying hello to Danny Schechter. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
How are you? You know, the approach you're taking is exactly right and exactly what's needed and exactly what's missing from most of the media, which just treats this like a sports event. Who's up? Who's down? It's a horse race approach to reporting, driven by statistics, projections, and the like, with very little background, very little depth about what the issues are in the states or about these candidates, how much money went into their races, who was funding them, how they were attempting to project their message, and the role the media itself played in their success or lack of success. And this is one of the things that's missing, is any sort of deeper analysis of what's behind our politics and what's shaping it. This is a media election that we're seeing now, and the media pundits are calling the shots here. I think that's why the Rally for Sanity was such an exercise in media criticism, because media criticism is so essential to understanding what actually is happening here. So I like to be jumping back in the discussion as we continue tonight. I just want to tell people this is an extremely unique approach to election night coverage, and an extremely important one, because we have to ask some deeper questions. What is going to happen tomorrow? Is the economy going to improve suddenly because Republicans are elected? Very unlikely. In fact, what should happen tomorrow is that Ben Bernanke is going to announce some sort of new stimulus plan for the economy, and everybody's going to condemn it, but Wall Street is going to welcome it. They see it as essential to the markets going up. So you have a situation here where the idea that these people are going to cut the deficit is very improbable and very unlikely. And so I think what we're seeing here is a grand deception and a game of politics without any substance. And that's why, you know, Progressive Radio Network can do what it can do in bringing other voices into the fray, helping us understand the deeper issues of our time. So I'll be joining you again a little bit later on, and I'm really pleased to be part of this, and that, you know, Progressive Radio Network is responding to this situation by actually having a special election night coverage, and hopefully helping to clarify the issues that the media is not clarifying in any way. So that's where I'm coming from. I'm in a car racing to an event in Brooklyn that I'll be speaking at, and then I'll be calling back in a little bit later. Good luck with this show.
Thank you very much, Danny. We look forward to speaking with you a little later on. Now, I'm going to bring our next two panelists up, Norman Solomon and Walt Thiesman. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Gary.
Thank you very much for having us on, Gary.
I want to start by looking at issues that have not been covered and are not likely to be covered. And I'd like to introduce a commentary first, and then we'll start from this commentary. I think that we need something a little deeper than the trivia that we see in the media. I was just watching all the different channels, and Marshall McCune, who was Canadian and came up with some very interesting insights, said that the media is the message. And it certainly is apparent tonight when, on the one hand, you have Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, and a host of liberals. On the other hand, you have on Fox, you have Bill O'Reilly saying that he's glad that Grayson from Florida is being defeated. And so the people who believe in them will no longer challenge the rightness of who wins or loses as long as they're aligned with them. And I'm saying, hold on a second. You're assuming these people have the depth, the compassion, the humanistic values, the intellect, and the objectivity to dissect an issue, even know which issues are truly relevant, and to give some informed input. And I don't see that in any of these individuals. I see so much bias. That's starting I want to start with a commentary from The Guardian by George Montabaut. He says, the progressive attempt to appeal to self-interest has been a catastrophe. Empathy, not expediency, must drive our campaigns. And I'll quote this. So here we are, forming an orderly line at the slaughterhouse gate. The punishment of the poor for the errors of the rich. The abandonment of universalism, the dismantling of the shelter the state provides. Apart from a few small protests, none of this has yet brought us out fighting. The acceptance of policies that counteract our interest is the pervasive mystery of the 21st century. In the United States, blue-collar workers angrily demand that they be left without health care and insist that millionaires pay less tax. In the United Kingdom, we appear ready to abandon the social progress for which our ancestors risked their lives with barely a mutter of protest. What has happened to us? The answer, I think, is provided by the most interesting report I've read this year, Common Cause, written by Tom Crompton of the Environmental Group, examines a series of fascinating recent advances in the field of psychology. It offers, I believe, a remedy to the blight that now afflicts every good cause, from welfare to climate change. Progressives, he shows, have been suckers for a myth of human cognition he labels the Enlightenment model. This holds that people make rational decisions by assessing facts. All that has to do to persuade people is to lay out the data. They will then use it to decide which options best support their interests and desires. A host of psychological experiments demonstrate it doesn't work like this. Instead of performing a rational cost-benefit analysis, we accept information that confirms our identity and our values, and reject information, no matter how beneficial it is, that conflicts with them. We mold our thinking around our social identity, protecting it from serious challenge. Confronting people with inconvenient facts is likely only to harden their resistance to change. Our social identity is shaped by values that psychologists classify as extrinsic or intrinsic. Extrinsic values concern status and self-advancement. People with a strong set of these values fixate on how others see them. They cherish financial success, image, and fame. Intrinsic values concern relationships with friends, family, and community, and self-acceptance. Those who have a strong set of intrinsic values are not dependent on praise or rewards or social status or materialism from other people. They have beliefs that transcend their self-interest. Few people are all one or the other. Our social identity is formed by a mixture of values, but psychological tests in nearly 70 countries show that values cluster in remarkably consistent patterns. Those who strongly value financial success, for example, have less empathy, stronger manipulative tendencies, a stronger attraction to hierarchy and inequality, stronger prejudices towards strangers, and less concern about human rights and suffering of others and the environment. Those with a strong sense of self-acceptance have more empathy, greater concern for human rights and social justice and the environment. These values suppress each other. The stronger someone's extrinsic aspirations, the weaker his or her intrinsic goals. We're not born with our values. They are shaped by the social environment. By changing our perception of what is normal and acceptable, politics alters our minds as much as our circumstances. Free, universal health care, for example, tends to reinforce intrinsic values. Shutting the door out of it normalizes inequality, reinforcing extrinsic values. The rightward shift that began with Margaret Thatcher and persisted under Tony Blair and Nat Brown, whose governments emphasized the virtue of competition, the market, and financial success, has changed our values. The British social attitudes show sharp falls over this period in public support for policies that redistribute wealth and opportunity. It becomes more selfish. This shift has been reinforced by advertising and the media. Their fascination with power politics, their rich lists, their categories of the top most 100 powerful, influential, intelligent, or beautiful people, their obsessive promotion of celebrity, fashion, fast cars, expensive holidays, all inculcate extrinsic values by generating feelings of insecurity and inadequacy, which means reducing self-acceptance. They also suppress intrinsic goals. Advertisers who employ plenty of psychologists as well are well aware of this. Crompton quotes Guy Murphy, global planning director for JWT. Marketers, quote, should see themselves as trying to manipulate culture, being social engineers, not brand managers, manipulating cultural forces, not brand impressions. The more they foster extrinsic values, the easier it is to sell products. In the end, politicians are products. Networks are products. The candidates that you're told to vote for are products. So it is irrelevant whether or not these individuals are good or bad, right or wrong on the issues. They're products. They're being marketed as such. And right-wing politicians have also instinctively understood the importance of values in changing the political map. Margaret Thatcher famously remarked that economics are the method. The object is to change the heart and the soul. Conservatives in the U.S. generally avoid debating facts and figures. Instead, they frame issues in ways that appeal to and reinforce extrinsic values. Every year, through mechanisms that are rarely visible and seldom discussed, the space in which progressive ideas can flourish shrinks a little more. The progressive response has been disastrous. Instead of confronting the shift in values, we have sought to adapt to it. Once progressive parties have tried to appease altered public attitudes, think of all those new labor appeals to Middle England, often just a code for self-interest. In doing so, they endorse and legitimize extrinsic values. Many Greens and social justice campaigners and candidates have also tried to reach people by appealing to self-interest, explaining how, for example, relieving poverty in the developing world will build a market for British products or American products, or suggesting that by buying a hybrid car, you can impress your friends and enhance your social status. This tactic also strengthens extrinsic values, making future campaigns even less likely to succeed. Green consumerism has been a catastrophic mistake. Common Cause proposes a simple remedy, that we stop seeking to bury our values and instead explain and champion them. Progressive campaigners, it suggests, should help to foster an understanding of the psychology that informs political change and show how it has been manipulated. They should also come together to challenge forces, particularly the advertising industry that makes us insecure and selfish. Ed Miliband appears to understand this need. He told the labor conference that he wants to change our society so that it values community and family, not just work, and wants to change our foreign policy so that it's always based upon values, not alliances. We must shed our old thinking and stand up for those who believe there is more to life than the bottom line. But there's a paradox here, which means that we cannot rely on politicians to drive these changes. Those who succeed in politics, by definition, people who prioritize extrinsic values are selfish. They are ambitious, and they must supplant peace of mind, family life, friendship, honesty and ethics, even brotherly love. So who then will lead us if the people who are championing it are all compromised? People with strong intrinsic values must cease to be embarrassed by them. We should argue for the policies we want not on the grounds of expediency, but on the grounds that they are empathetic and kind, and against others on the grounds that they are selfish and cruel. In asserting our values, we become the change we want to see. Now, I'm going to go to both of you for your comments. I just want to give one quick comment of myself here. How many times have I seen Glenn Beck say that all progressives should be destroyed? That the progressives are the most evil force on earth, that if you're a progressive, you're a Marxist, a socialist, you're a communist, that if you're a liberal, you are a communist, Marxist, socialist, or progressive, and then rattle off completely false histories to make his point. For the record, if anyone on the right or anyone within the Tea Party movement would like to have a conversation with someone who prides himself on being an independent progressive humanist with a strong spiritual value, that is how I classify myself. A small business advocate, a person who believes in family values and moral and ethical considerations, believing that the strength of a community is to respect the needs of the community, and getting back to basic values, to shrink our government back by 50% at the federal level at least, not to throw away the protections the government can give us, but rather to actually strengthen the protections necessary, the reestablishment of the Glass-Steagall Act and strengthen the Commodity Future Trading Act, and to have a ban and outlaw on all tradings and commodities essential to life, water, fuel, food, to allow then freedoms of choice, to bring democracy in its purest form into the marketplace, to establish no private funding, only public funding for all elections, and have elections, therefore, that last only 3 months in cycle. People then are all filling out the same forms for the world to see who wants. What are your values? What are you going to do? What will you bring to the job? What do you intend to change? So we can choose that person without people being excluded because they're not a part of the Democrat or Republican corporatocracy. Also, it then denies access by the Koch brothers and by on the right and by George Soros and others on the left to manipulate the process from behind the scenes, which is done now with over 44,000 lobbyists from different groups, with think tanks, with foundations, all of which are there to serve those people who are the real power elite, who are never held accountable and never debating the issue. Always their surrogates do so. To put a foreclosure in the marketplace is ridiculous. There should be a moratorium on all foreclosures. Bring the cost of every house right now, the mortgage, down to the actual market value. So if your house cost you $200,000, your mortgage $200,000, but the market is $100,000, immediately that mortgage should be at $100,000. All late fees and interest above 2% should be forgiven, so no one's run out of their house. And then give interest-free loans of 0%, the same advantage a bank gets, the individual and small business should get, and give them a tax holiday for 3 years, providing that for every $1 million of a loan they give, they have to hire an employee at $30, a living wage, not a minimum wage. And within 3 years, you would probably have 5 to 7 million new people doing business. And that would be about 25 to 30 million new people working at living wages. Microloans worked originally in Indonesia and in India. Today they do not, because then a person could only pay 1% interest and the average amount of a loan was $200. But it allowed millions of people who were poor to be able to buy seed or product to start their own business. And it worked. The man won the Nobel Prize for discovering it. Today, it has been exploited as would be expected. The average interest rate on a microloan is 25%, but it's not unheard to have 100% interest, 100% on a microloan to a poor person. So everything gets exploited, and unfortunately, so too has everyone in our economy. That said, we could completely gut the bureaucracies of waste, duplicity, insider contracts, eliminate all subsidies for all major industries and allow no lobbying, make it a federal offense. I would make it a federal offense for anyone to lobby for anything so that the only person allowed to go in and see a legislator is a citizen who voted for them. So bring back the rights to the states. Now, so show me, Glenn Beck, in that proposal, what would you be against? You say you want to cut the budget. Would you be willing to cut the military-industrial complex if I could show you that $800 billion of it is waste, insider trading, systems that will never be used, and only $200 billion is necessary out of $1 trillion? Would you be willing? Or are you going to do what all the Republicans have done to date and all the conservatives? We want to cut government, but we don't want to cut subsidies for major corporations in agribusiness, in energy, in pharmacology, or the pharmaceutical industry, and in hospitals or insurance. So then you want to what? Cut the subsidies for the poor or the middle class? You're hypocritical then. And why can't the people in the Tea Party see the hypocrisy on the right and how they're being manipulated and used? And so those are my own thoughts. Gentlemen, we will start with you, and let's start with Norman Solomon. The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, thanks for those insights. I think we're at a very difficult time right now. You know, unfortunately, I have this prior commitment at the bottom of the hour, but for a couple of minutes here, I would say that we have different layers involved. We have the problems that you outlined that are structural, they're psychological, they're deeply cultural. And I think a lot of our cultural upbringing includes strong bias in terms of organizing. We don't have an organizing culture. And that's true, unfortunately, among many that we call progressives. Ironically, the right wing in the last year at the base, at their grassroots, have become much more actualizing in terms of their capacity to organize, unfortunately for ill, as you mentioned, the Tea Party with its own set of, I would call them, anti-principles. So I think the analysis is absolutely key, and I'm struck by the way in which our invocation of values needs to be matched by our capacity to organize through media, creation of independent media, and at the grassroots, at the community level. And I think that is a sort of a missing piece in terms of our capacity to organize, not particularly for elections, although it would be inclusive of that, but let's remind ourselves that our schools, our mass media do not teach us how to be assertive in meaningful ways. They tacitly or actively teach us to be passive. And it is that passivity that encourages us not to work together to organize, and we do need to turn that around.
Norman, do you also find that our comfort by what we do have has made us weak and non-assertive?
Well, it sort of depends on who we are, because as you know, Howard Zinn used to say, there's not the economy, there are many economies, and there are many layers of comfort and non-comfort. A lot of material distress in our society, we could say that some of it is, you know, based on false assumptions as to what is needed, but there is some real genuine distress in terms of scarcity, healthcare, even some other realms of housing, you know. So I think that there's a comfort level for many of us that is anesthetizing. But at the same time, I think that there is genuine and increasing distress because, particularly at the material plane, which we do need substance, the world is such that so many people are suffering, as we know, globally. And some of our own national capacity to be relatively comfortable is eroding, and I think that is a dynamic as well.
One last question. I know you have to leave, but I need to ask you this. The Democrats have historically positioned or posited themselves as being the party of compassion and ones who are connected at the visceral heart level with the poor, the middle class, the working class. I find that's completely an abject falsehood. It is a myth, and it is the myth of the story of being a Democrat today. I was once a Democrat and a liberal. I would absolutely not be either of those today. Now, why? Because if Bill Clinton is going to go to Haiti, which is good, and bring a light to their suffering, why is it no politician, including Bill Clinton or Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or the heads of Goldman Sachs or anyone else, has paid any attention whatsoever to the hungry 12 million children in the United States, the 40 million Americans who go to bed hungry, the 5 million who are living on the streets, the 20 million who are homeless? They have been foreclosed on, so they're living wherever they can live, but are really homeless. Why haven't we paid any attention to the suffering in the United States, especially by the Democrats and the liberals, who will, in their conceit, tell you that they are the party of compassion? And I do not see that, especially with the Clintonites and the Blue Dog Democrats or the conservative Democrats. Your thoughts, please.
it's a huge tragedy that the war on poverty, so-called, was surrendered several decades ago, and it's been an atrocious abdication of moral responsibility among those who have had a majority in the House for the last 4 years. I would just sort of close by saying that there is a tremendous failure to step up to the moral plate, so to speak, around poverty, as you mentioned, including at home. And at the same time, 2 weeks ago, I was in Tucson, Arizona, at a rally and some organizing on behalf of Raul Grijalva, now 8 years into his term as a member of Congress. He has a Democrat label, and he's been a genuine community organizer for decades. He's a fighter for poor people. And I think that we have different tags for different folks, but those tags sometimes obscure the vast differentiation between them. And I would go to the ramparts and fight for Raul Grijalva any day of the week, and he's under massive attack by xenophobes. We'll know in a few hours whether they've been successful in knocking him out of the House.
I appreciate your input, Norman Solomon. Hopefully people will continue listening to your program here on the Progressive Radio Network. It is one of our best and most popular. People can listen to it on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m., and it's called Politics and Possibilities. Thank you very much, Norman Solomon.
Hey, thank you, Gary.
And he is one of America's foremost political and media experts. Now let's go over and say hello to Walt Thiessen. Walt, nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me on, Gary.
Walt, you take a look now at the scenario that we're looking at. None of the politicians, right, left, or the Tea Party, have talked about getting out of the war in Iraq, getting out of the war in Afghanistan. And by the way, even though we drew down 50,000 troops, we replaced them with 50,000 private contractors who were paying $1,200 apiece for. And we're now at $3 trillion, and Joseph Stiglitz, who I filmed for my new documentary, has now stated on the record that he grossly underestimated the figures, and it'll probably be double that, or $5 to $6 trillion. Now, no one's talking about getting out of the wars. No one is talking about reducing the military-industrial complex or any of the subsidies for any special industries. No one's talking about stopping the lobbyists from writing the laws and taking away provisions that protect us. No one's talking about anything that involves our environment. In fact, even to mention the environment, you're considered a cap-and-trader. And I want to know why we're not talking about the difference between reducing the size of government and reducing the ineffective parts of government and keeping what works with civilian oversight instead of simply going at it like a person putting on a blindfold, going into a butcher shop and whacking away with a meat cleaver, expecting something positive to happen, which the Green, which the Tea Party and the right and the left are all, I feel, guilty of. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that if we're going to really look at this, we have to realize that there is a common thread that runs through all the issues you've touched on in the past half hour and all of the issues that remain untouched on because you simply can't go through them all within a half hour's time. But there's one issue that never gets addressed. It never gets addressed by the left. It never gets addressed by the right, although the right have learned how to mouth the platitudes that would attract those who are interested in the issue. And granted, the number who are interested in it at this point in time is a relatively small number. But nevertheless, in my opinion, it is the only political issue. And I know that sounds like a rather strange thing to say because there's a pamphlet of issues out there. But in my view, there's really only one political issue, and all the rest of them are sub-issues. And that issue is the monetary and banking system. And obviously the reason I say that is because it's what drives all the rest of the issues. The fact that we have a monetary and banking system that can essentially fund any political agenda that any person can dream up is what leads us to this panoply of issues that doesn't get addressed because there's just so much money being spent on everything. And it's always the money that's behind everything. I think really the left is particularly guilty on this issue because the left has done an abysmal job of addressing the root nature of the monetary and banking system in its actuality, not in terms of what they want to be, but in terms of what it actually is. And the right they barely touch on it at all when they even discuss it. But the one place where it did start to show up was in the early version of the Tea Party. So the Tea Party basically started one way and they turned into something completely different. Let me just touch on that for a minute. The Tea Party, many people don't realize this, but the Tea Party actually originated back in the 2007 presidential campaign of Ron Paul and led up to the Tea Party money bomb on December 16, 2007. And then after the presidential campaign was over, they evolved into the Glenn Beck 9/12 type stuff. And basically the Tea Party discussion was co-opted over into the right-wing discussion of guns, gays, and God, and that kind of thing. But the bottom line was, it was originally the Ron Paul movement, and the Ron Paul Tea Party movement was originally about the economy, the currency, the monetary crisis, all of the core issues that are basically surrounding the monetary and banking system. That's been lost from the Tea Party. And I think that's kind of what you're addressing when you talk about the, I don't remember the word you used, I'll call it the bankruptcy of the Tea Party movement. Because the Tea Party movement is not only morally bankrupt at this point, they're basically dead. They've lost their original impetus. They've lost the reason for being. And I really honestly think that despite the fact that the Tea Parties are going to count a lot of victories tonight, their day is pretty much done. And it's mainly done because they lost their way and they have essentially been brought back into the Republican fold, which is exactly what the Republican operatives wanted to do.
And if it were not for the independents, three of the people who won tonight or being declared winners would not have won. The Tea Party gave them 22, 26, and 28%, but it was the independents that took them up another 25%. Let us remember that 42% of all voters today are independents, and about 10% of those are now realizing that going one step further, don't just be an independent, but look for solutions that lie outside the existing paradigm. If you're trying to to dumpster dive into the Democrat or Republican cesspools, you're going to come up a mess. There are no solutions on the conservative or liberal side of this agenda. We must go towards a more humanistic, a more environmental friendly, a more practical sense. You just mentioned that finance is behind it all. Of course finances are behind it all.
But for example, it's more than just the finances being behind it. It's how the finances are created.
Let me give an example. Here's something that no media has touched. This is from Andrew Gavin Marshall. Crisis is an opportunity, engineering a global depression to create a global government. I'll quote this. In May of this year, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, managing director of the International Monetary Fund, stated that, quote, crisis is an opportunity, and called for a new global currency issued by a global central bank with a robust governance and institutional features. And the global central bank could also serve as a leader of last resort. And therefore, only those countries that are aware of how important it is to get one currency. And with one currency comes one government. The process of globalization has firmly established a global integrated economic system, and now the global economic crisis is facilitating the implementation of global economic governance to create the economic apparatus of a global government, including a global central bank and a global currency. This process is exponentially accelerated through economic crisis, which create the need, desire, urgency, and means of establishing a structure of global economic governance, purportedly under the guise of preventing economic crisis and maintaining global economy. And in conclusion, the same institutions and actors responsible for creating our current crisis are then given the job of determining the solution and are then given the power and means of implementing it. Problem, reaction, solution. They create a problem to incur a particular reaction for which they then propose a predetermined solution. When pressure needs to be applied to individual states that are not following dictates of the institutions of global governance, the market is turned against them, and in a barrage of economic warfare, often in the form of currency speculation and derivative trading, the result of this economic warfare against a nation is that it must then turn to its same global institutions to come to its rescue. Problem, reaction, solution. The global economic crisis, really having only just begun, will in years to come spiral into to a great global debt depression, plunging the entire world into the greatest economic catastrophe ever known, this will be the ultimate catalyst, the most pervasive crisis, the most commanding opportunity to implement the formation of a global government. In 1988, The Economist, the famous magazine, ran an article entitled Get Ready for the Phoenix, in which it postulated that by the year 2018, 8 years from now, there will be a global currency which it termed the Phoenix. The mention of a Phoenix is not to go unnoticed, as symbolically a Phoenix dies and from its ashes a new Phoenix emerges. It is the symbol of destruction as a form of creation, the ultimate incarnation of crisis as an opportunity. And the article in The Economist acknowledged this meaning with the idea that economic and monetary collapse will likely lead to the formation of a global currency, and with that, a global government. Now, does anyone on the left, are any of the Democratic parties talking about it? No. The moment you mention anything that shows that there are individuals conspiring to manipulate currencies, conspiring to manipulate staying in wars or creating wars, they say there are no conspiracies. So the left has never seen a conspiracy, evidently, and they don't want to talk about it. And yet it is not the right that sees the conspiracy. It is the progressives, it is the independents, and it is the libertarians that seem to be able to understand that we are in crisis because people have engineered it. Your thoughts?
And of course, the fact that they're trying to take us to that one world government, that one world currency, only exacerbates all the different effects that we've seen out of the control of the monetary system that is here right now in a relatively fragmented system, even though it's highly centralized in its own way. So obviously that's taking us in the wrong direction. But the thing that I notice even more than looking at it on this global scale like this, I look at it more on the individual scale. I have conversations with individuals, right, left, center, everywhere on the political spectrum, people who consider themselves to be non-political at all. And I'm fascinated by the fact that probably 9 out of 10 have no concept how the monetary system works, none whatsoever. And when I start to explain some of the basics to them, how it's a debt-based monetary system, how money is created by making deposits in your bank and the bank loaning the money out and counting it as both a liability and asset, assuming, of course, that their eyes don't cross and they go into a dizzying sweat because they don't follow all the discussion, assuming I can keep the terminology as simple as possible, their eyes are open. They're like amazed, like, why hasn't anybody ever told me this before? And the reason I'm even mentioning that point is, as bad as the left has been at connecting, and you were doing a little bit of a monologue on that earlier, connecting on a heart level, connecting on a personal level, as bad as they've been at that, I have to say they have a better history of being able to explain things than the right has been. And so that's why it's a bit perplexing to me that the left have not realized that they're the ones who need to explain the monetary system to the people. Because until they get that, until they get the idea that that's where the whole thing starts, that's the crux, that's the root, that's what drives the entire system, and until they start teaching that, I don't really see how any amount of philosophizing can win back an approach that's going to start pushing the left further into the mainstream, further into acceptance by the majority.
Very, very good insight, Walt. My only caveat to your statement would be that you're asking the left that has been in power for the past 4 years to explain the problem that their people in power have created.
Well, let's be fair. It's actually been created by both the right and the left over a period of years. But over the last 4 years, it's certainly the left who's been driving it.
I agree. But you're not going to have Lauren Summers. You're not going to have Timothy Geithner. You're not going to have Robert Rubin coming forward with any of the other individuals in power and Bernanke and say, look, it's all game. We're just tomorrow going to print another $1.3 trillion. It will be monetized. We don't have anyone buying that debt. And we're going to make sure that that money is set aside in our bank. It won't even be transferred, so that the leading five banks, all of whom are bankrupt, J.P. Morgan has now $96 trillion in derivative positions. It's bankrupt. So are the top five. But we're going to keep it there for their use. We're even going to give them interest on it. They're going to pay zero interest to get it. They're going to get 2 to 2.4% interest in return. And you're going to think, well, hold on a second. Why give those banks that caused this problem where there's $600 trillion out there in credit default swap and derivative positions, why give them that money when you could be giving it to small business people? You could be putting it into infrastructural change. You could be de-ghettoizing America, and they're going to say, you just don't get it.
Well, I think the mistake is looking to somebody like a Larry Summers or Timothy Geithner to lead you. It's just as silly as the right expecting a Hank Paulson to lead them, because neither is going to lead them in the direction that we need to be led in. So I say, let's stop looking to them for leadership. Let's look for leadership at perhaps a lower level, a level of person who really does understand and is willing to address the root causes of the monetary system's issues. I don't think you can look to Wall Street to lead us out of this.
Oh, well, of course we can't. But
that's where those people come from.
But I'm saying
Larry Summers comes from Harvard, but, you know, nevertheless.
Yeah, he was president of Harvard. And while he was president of Harvard, he was then selected to replace Robert Rubin, who then went to be on the board of Harvard because of that. But I'm suggesting that we have got to stop looking at the right, the left, the conservative, the liberal, the Tea Party. None of them have the answers or the honesty. Not always are they dishonest by some form of malicious contempt for the truth, but many times they're simply so ignorant of this, the homework. They have not done their homework, as you have, as John Rappaport coming up in a moment has, and others, that they only go by this marching orders they're given. And that's why we have to get the 42% of Americans who are independent, who at one time were Democrat or Republican, to start looking for the truth and then living by it and promoting it in whatever way they can. And I believe that we need another really good documentary on the Federal Reserve. I believe we need a documentary on the World Trade Organization, one of the most corrupt organizations in history. And if I were to ask every member of Congress and every member of the media right now, name me five people who work for the World Trade Organization, they couldn't name me one. I would bet my life on it. And yet these are the people that control our futures. These are the elites. They even exceed the Koch brothers, because the Koch brothers are simply two very rich energy cartel individuals, but they do not have the larger agenda that the real powerful elite, the banking elite, have. And the Koch brothers are simply selfish, egotistical people who see their own interest of deregulation and not cleaning up their own energy industries that would cost them money. That's where their interest is. They're easy. They'd be very easy foils. I'm talking about the really smart guys that run these international banking cartels and are the largest shareholders and controllers of the independent Federal Reserve banks. I want to thank you very much for being with us today, Walt. Stay on the line if you'd like.
I can stay for a few minutes.
Okay, and your show is on Thursdays from 6 to 7 o'clock here on the Progressive Radio Network. By the way, it's one of our most popular programs.
Yeah, it's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and we do focus on financial issues on that program, so if you want to learn more, that's a good way to tune in. And also, if I can put in a little plug for myself, I have a novel out, a book about the financial crisis called The Money Suckers, which is now on sale. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble online, and it's a great way to get a first-step introduction to the whole concept of monetary policy and the banking system without having to know anything about economics, because I wrote it as a novel rather than as a nonfiction book or as a textbook, just so that people could enjoy a story and then kind of pick up these concepts as they go throughout it. So check it out.
Good. It's called The Money Suckers.
The Money Suckers, yeah. And in fact, The Money Suckers is my term for the people who run, who pull the strings of the monetary system.
Thank you. I appreciate your input, Walt. Walt Thiessen, T-H-I-E-S-S-E-N, my guest. Now let's go over and say hello to one of America's finest independent journalists, award-winning investigative reporter, John Rappaport. He is the author of AIDS, Inc., Myths of AIDS, Then and Now. He has a program on the Progressive Radio Network, and he's with us on the other line. He's on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m., tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Nice to have you with us today, John.
Nice to be here, Gary. Hi.
Hi, John. We're looking at the election not by left, right, or green, the Tea Party. We're looking at the issues they're not touching. We're looking at what we're not being told. We're looking at those individuals who had the power to control the outcome of elections, and what a farce many of these elections are, since they're really about commodifying candidates, buying them. And I wasn't aware growing up that a candidate who would oversee what is important in our lives was simply a commodity. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I ran for Congress in 1994 in a Democratic primary out here in Los Angeles against Henry Waxman. And it was quite an experience because Waxman decided that even though there was tremendous interest in the health freedom issue, which was the platform on which I was initially running, that there just wouldn't be enough organization in my campaign. And so he decided to absolutely stay in Washington and never come to Los Angeles to campaign at all. And the largest public cable company in West LA at the time, Century, there was a guy there who kind of liked me, and I was on one of his shows. He was the manager of the network. And he said, look, I'm going to try to get Waxman to come here and debate you. I said, great. This is exactly what I want. In fact, this is the problem. You know, we had a discussion about this. I said, you can't get these people on the record to actually talk about the kinds of issues that you're raising here tonight. And I would do that. I would push him against the wall. I would demand that he talk about these issues and make him look ridiculous if he wouldn't. This is what we need. We need actual substantive debate on the invisible issues that are controlling this country and other countries and soon to be the whole planet. So he tried. Waxman refused. In fact, as I say, he didn't even show up in Los Angeles for a campaign at all. He didn't spend any money on ads at all because his staff decided that they had it in the bag. And they did, although there's some question in my mind about the vote count, but that's a whole other issue. So that's what happened in that election. And I inferred from that, because I've talked to other people who've tried to run. In my case, it was running as a Democrat because as an independent, I would be sunk from the start. But, you know, who are basically independent thinkers who see these larger issues. And the problem, I think, that we all face has to do with what appears to be a sort of a ceiling on how much information we can get out to people that actually wakes them up to see these larger issues. We, you know, you've got a network there that's fantastic, and there are other networks of alternative news, especially, of course, with the Internet and so on. But there is the sense that somewhere there is this kind of ceiling. We can go this far, we can expand our influence to this point, but when it comes to the so-called opinion leaders, the major media, the anchors, the people who do the reporting, the politicians, and of course, you know, the many people who are invisible, as you pointed out, behind them, who are really pulling the strings, where do you get these people into a forum where you can show exactly who they are and what they are to a sufficient number of people in the country so that we experience a sea change? How do we do that? And I've had various ideas for that in the past, one of which is you start a PR agency. You actually have a public relations agency whose purpose it is to tell the truth about the things that really matter. And you approach it from a public relations standpoint. How do you get stories in the press, the mainstream press? Where do you start? How do you move into that territory and make the kinds of connections on certain issues that will expand knowledge and information? How do you push that forward? How do you make progress? And the other would be a debate channel, where in the tradition of, say, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, certain political debates that occurred over a century ago when people in this country were educated to a much greater degree, understood what logic was all about, for example, were thoroughly schooled in it, were willing to sit somewhere for a couple of hours or more and actually hear candidates try to prove their points. But of course, this would not be limited to political debates. It would be limited, it would be expanded into debates on, for example, as you were just discussing, who is really running the show here. Who is trying to produce a global currency and therefore global governance? What is this all about? What is the WTO? And these kinds of issues, in significantly long debates, exposing it to hopefully millions of people who I believe would eventually wake up and realize that this is what they've been waiting for. I've been watching the California campaign between Brown and Whitman out here, and I have to say, it's just about the most horrendous thing that I've ever seen politically, because even though I've seen thousands of TV ads before, these ads are so bereft of content, so meaningless, costing millions and millions of dollars that could be spent in other directions, that there is, it just crumbles in your hands like an old cookie. There's nothing to this campaign, nothing to the debate, nothing to the election, nothing to nothing. And so the thought has crossed my mind a number of times. We need a 24-hour-a-day debate channel. Just like C-SPAN has its, you know, endless droning coverage. But this would be alive. It would be electric. You would have people who would actually speak about the important things. And one of those, to me, is what is government? What is it supposed to be? Let's hear Ron Paul for a couple of hours. Let's hear libertarians debate, left, politically left people. Let's have libertarians forced to explain their position in depth on what government is, and likewise, force people on the political left to describe the philosophy that underlies their votes or their favoring certain issues over other issues. What do they really suppose government is in this country, for example? Aren't they really telling us that government is everything and that the people are nothing? I mean, is that really the philosophy that underpins this? Let's hear it in lengthy form. Let's make people tell the whole truth about their political positions in this country. And that would be just one type of debate. But the other, which I would love to see, you know, is the point that you brought up with Walt. What is this global governance all about that we seem to be going toward? What is this financial meltdown that suddenly becomes an opportunity for global currency? Who will explain all of this to us, and who will debate the person on the other side and try to uphold a different view? Air it all out at great length. Let's break through the ceiling. Let's take what, you know, you've been doing for years, for example, as, I don't know what even to call it, but, you know, as your own media network, even before you started this, and others who know what the real issues are that are not being even faintly discussed. And let's try to bring it all to yet another level.
Gary, could I jump in for just a second here?
Yeah, sure.
Because I think I can address something that John's bringing up here. John, you mentioned the idea of a debate channel and of a forum for bringing different ideas together. And I like the idea a lot. In fact, I like it so much that I've actually created a few years ago a website that attempts to do just that.
Mm.
One of the things that I learned, the website, by the way, is the Nolan Chart, www.nolanchart.com. One of the things that I've learned in the process of creating that website and trying to encourage left-right libertarians, authoritarians, moderates, all to come together into one forum, is that they're reluctant to do so.
Yeah.
There's a tendency among not just Americans, but I think among people all over the planet, to want to stick with your own group. And even though on the website I group articles by the different contributors in terms of liberal, conservative, libertarian, moderate, and so on and so forth, despite that fact, the tendency to isolate is still there. Add in the fact that my own views are libertarian, so there tends to be more libertarians who come to the site. And it's been one of my biggest frustrations trying to figure out, how do I encourage more conservatives? How do I encourage more liberals? How do I encourage more moderates to participate?
Well, I
think that's
one
thing that you really
have
to address with your debate channel. That's the one most important thing you have to figure out.
I think it has to be video. I think it has to be live, in fact, a lot of the time. Because I do believe that more people would be willing to maybe venture out of, as you say, their isolated groups if they could see it. If they could see the people, if they could watch their faces, if they could see the words coming out of their mouths and their body language and the whole thing, that it would be something that they would be more attracted magnetically to.
John, let me intercede here for a moment. I think both you, John Rapoport, and Walt Thiessen both have an excellent idea, and tomorrow I'll discuss this with our program director, because we're building a new state-of-the-art studio here in New York City. I'm in an old building. It's a 1910 theater with 25-foot-high ceilings and a 4,000-square-foot main room. And I'm going to make that into a major studio, a film studio and television and radio
wow.
studio. And I will ask her to start putting this together. Now, here was my thought, and it coalesces with something both of you said. John is known for writing, among other things, AIDS, Inc. Now, I've written over, I've done 6 award-winning documentaries, a book, and 14 articles. I've done maybe 100 broadcasts, but never could I get anyone within the AIDS community like ACT UP, that I consider responsible for hundreds of thousands of wrongful death, Bill Gates, Bill Clinton, the people who are sponsoring drugs to Africa, to look at the facts. And the only people thus far, the left rejected it entirely. Democracy Now, they're pro-AIDS drugs. They'll never allow discussion on this topic. In fact, they'll say you're an AIDS denier. We say no to the contrary. I've worked with over 2,000 people with AIDS and All helped right. them using natural therapy. I'm not in denial. I'm challenging that everything about AIDS that you've told us is wrong. And by the way, just on this program, 8 weeks ago, Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize last year for discovering the HIV virus, by himself, interesting enough, the so-called co-founder, a co-discoverer, didn't get anything. But he said, twice, he said that if you take antioxidants, you won't get the HIV virus. And if you have the HIV virus and take antioxidants, you'll get well and it gets out of your system. He had never said that before.
Wow.
So now I'm saying, okay, there are a whole lot of us, but mainly it's the independent and progressive and libertarians who are willing to look at the science behind global warming, the science behind AIDS, the science behind fluoride, mercury in your teeth, the science behind adulterated diet, pesticides, genetically engineered foods. But the people on the Democrats absolutely refused to get engaged in going against genetically modified companies like Monsanto. They refused to look at the conspiracies like trying to pass the Senate Bill 750 right now that would ban all organic food in the United States and would harmonize with the World Trade Organization genetic engineered food. They refused to look at this. We send articles. I've sent every single documentary I've done. Gulf War Syndrome, Killing Our Own. The United States government, by the way, this week, as we speak, a full-page ad, $11,000 ad, in the Nation magazine that we put in there, U.S. government to Gulf War vets dropped dead, and how more Gulf War vets will die in the United States than die in Iraq or Afghanistan. Why? And then we go through depleted uranium and everything else that they're affected by that the government's not treating. But do you think anyone on the left dealt with it? No one. Not a single outlet. And so I'm suggesting that we can come up with the ideas, whether it's the danger and lack of science and efficacy behind vaccines, but Paul Offit won't come on and debate us, even though he has a new book out. He'll go to ABC and promote this new book, how anybody who says vaccines are not necessary is a nut job and a quack. He won't come on, where we'll show that he is in gross conflict of interest, and he's wrong. So you name the topic that's important for our well-being, our health, the health of the planet, individuals, our society. No one on the opposition will debate it. Now, that doesn't mean we can't bring in, and here's what I would say would be a consolation. Take your idea, a darn good idea. But instead of having people fearful of coming on debating, especially if they don't have the facts or truth on their side, use that as a forum, as like a whistleblower forum to tell the truth on important social issues. Not a bantering show, not a discussion show, but hard-nosed investigative reporting. Because what don't we have anywhere except for 60 Minutes? Hard-nosed, independent, non-commercial investigative reporting. It just doesn't exist.
Right.
So this way, those people who are willing to investigate and report and bring their scholarship and bring their argument to the public forum, and then allow individuals in the field to be given that information in advance and say, would you come on and rebut this? Would you come on and respond to it? And then if they don't, then have it live so you have the public having a chance over the internet to come on and challenge it or agree with it or whatever they wish, where you would then moderate whatever it was that you were reporting on and do it as a weekly show with a group of individuals and each person who has something that has no form. Because right now, I must get 50 books a month that the person has written good scholarship, and they end up dying on the vine because nobody has them on. The left won't have them on unless it aligns with something on the right. They won't have them on. So I think that we could do something of a hybrid of your idea. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I like that. I think it's not really an either-or situation. It's like try to do it all. What your hybrid idea is perfect. It works. You never know. Sometimes you can get people to come on and debate. If they refuse, you can present the other side and indicate that you know, here are the people that you requested to present their views on this subject, and they declined, and then roll a scroll of their names and who they are, who would refuse to actually present their point of view.
Or have a chair with the sign saying that
he didn't show up.
He didn't show up and give his name, right?
Gary, yeah. That's actually another way to accomplish what you're trying to do. And by the way, I do like the idea of doing this as video, and I commend you for being able to put together that studio. It sounds fantastic. But the thing that I think that we need to do is to stop focusing on top famous personalities. We have this adoration in America. If somebody is a major scholar or a major politician or a major pundit, then they're the ones we have to have on. They're the ones who have to participate in the debate, and that's crazy. What's the most popular kind of TV today? Reality TV, dealing with average people. Why not find people who are not at the top echelon, but people who are simply representative of the various groups that you want to represent in a debate? Invite them to come in.
Fine with me.
Let's do that, too. I mean, you know, this is all inclusive. You can have many different formats so that it's never, you know, we'll do this instead of that, because, you know, if in an odd moment you could get Joe Biden to suddenly say, what the hell, I'm not doing anything today, and he suddenly is there, bangy bingy, you know, you've got something fantastic. But if not, I mean, you've got all kinds of formats you can do that are basically attuned to presenting sides of various issues that will ultimately inform the public. And the thing that I've noticed, I mean, I've been watching, you know, off and on Frontline for years and 60 Minutes for years and other formats, is that I believe in the country, in the populace, there is a hunger for debate. People would love to see two people up there talking about something that they really care about in the long form, not bantering, not, you know, fighting, not arguing, but, you know, one guy gets up for a very long period of time and presents it completely, and then the other guy does, and then you've got periods of response. I think there's something there, and I understand it's difficult to, in some cases, to make it happen because people refuse to come on, but you try it, and you try everything, because
then let's do it. I'm a person that does what I say I'm going to do. I don't dilly on it. You've come up with a brilliant idea. You've both made major contributions to the process of evolving it, and I would add one more to this concept. Give a written report so that it can go out over the internet. Because now if a person can't watch it, they can read about it. Then you put it in archives. Let me give you an example. This past year, we wrote 15 articles challenging the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Now, we did this just when they were hammering us with the H1N1, that it's a pandemic, but our research showed that they were lying. Now, how do we go about it? Well, what we did is we got the article and we challenged their science to show that they were lying, and then we put it out there. It went viral. 153,000 sites aired it. We're guesstimating that about 40 to 50 million people read it.
Wow.
And that's how now the Internet can be used as a tool that goes past the mainstream media. Because you know and I know the mainstream media is not going to have any of us on because we would wipe the floor with any of the pundits and the talking heads of the jerks that they have. And we have, and we've all been in these debates. I've been probably 500 debates. And we know they're not going to go against us. So this way, the public at large gets the information. They get the problem and the solution. They can watch it. If there's someone willing to come on and debate, fine. Then you have an independent moderator who gives each person the same amount of time, so they're fair. It's not one of these Bill O'Reilly. He screams, you listen, you
right.
say something, he denounces you, and you get off in 3 minutes. And he says, well, thanks for coming on. And then people say, what just happened, right?
Yeah.
What was that?
It was another ego fest.
Yeah, well, that's all he is. So I'm suggesting that as of tomorrow, I will put this in motion, and I'll be back in touch. Kara Lee will be back in touch with both of you.
Fabulous.
And let's see if we can't make this happen. Thank you very much, John Rappaport. Thank you very much, Walt Thiessen, for being with us today in our different approach to looking at the body politic and what's missing in our culture. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. We've been talking about what's missing in the body politic, what's missing in our dialogue discussions, what's missing is the scholarship, what's missing is the real issues that are really important, and the superficiality of how what we are dealing with has been usurped by special interest groups. We have Danny Schechter standing by. He's back on. He's coming in and out of our program tonight. We have David Swanson standing by and Bill Thompson standing by. Let's go over and say again hello to Danny Schechter. Hi, Danny.
Hey, Gary. How are you? I'm just coming back from Brooklyn where I addressed a panel discussion, quite a packed crowd, who are looking at the old commercials going back to the Goldwater days and the Lyndon Johnson days, the way political commercials have evolved and increasingly become more negative, more kind of attack ads, less informative about what any issues were. There was one done years ago about poverty, for example, which was deemed too depressing to put on the air. But, you know, so there's this whole political progression, you know, the Ronald Reagan Morning in America spots and all this, the way politics gets boiled down into images, gets boiled down into kind of a manipulated bunch of ideas and message points so that the public really doesn't understand what's going on, but they're basically encouraged to have a sort of Pavlovian reaction to it, to certain buzzwords which are used over and over again. I think we've seen that in this election as, you know, probably the worst so far when it came to this sort of thing and the use of attack ads and the rest. And, you know, I just think that what we're dealing with is a process that's been captured. You know, it's a phrase that's used when financial institutions sort of capture government agencies and turn them into instruments of their own to do their own bidding or make regulators instead of regulating, in a sense, enhance their agendas. And we're in a situation, you know, today where politics itself, democracy, seems to have been captured by these institutions. I've had a piece out, and I think it's up on the PRN website, about politics as a business. the way it's not just business advertising in politics, that politics itself has become a business. We're talking about billions of dollars in this election cycle on ads, consultants, and all sorts of professional operators essentially directing what issues will be talked about, which ones won't, and the like. And I think it's important for, our listeners and for everybody to follow all this, to look at this closely, to see how this process works and how they're being kind of victimized by it. You know, I raised a concern tonight, where people were talking about, well, the media is there to protect our democracy. It's there to, as a kind of watchdog. And I was saying it's become more of a lapdog. Can our democracy survive our media in its present form, I think, is the question that really has to be addressed. And that's why I think what you're doing on PRN and the various people who are coming on add a layer of analysis and understanding to these issues that are so conspicuously absent by the routines of electoral coverage. I'll bet if you blanked out the year and went back to the election coverage on election night in other years, it would be almost an exact replica of what we're hearing tonight.
I would agree with that, and I thank you very much for calling back in again, Danny.
Yeah, thank you.
And we'll look forward to hearing you one more time before the show's over. Let's go over and say hello to David Swanson. I introduced him earlier in our program, and he has served as Dennis Kucinich's press secretary. He is a very important voice with social and political activist groups around the United States. He is also the founder of the blog WarsACrime.org and his book Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. It's a very penetrating analysis into how government dupes citizens into believing it is working on their behalf. Nice to have you back with us, David.
Hey, it's great to be back, and great to hear my buddy Danny Schechter telling it like it is there.
David, give us your overview of what you see is missing in this current election cycle and what we need to do as independent and progressive minds to begin to create a platform upon which the next cycle we at least are visible, organized, and viable. Where this time around, unfortunately, with a few exceptions, Russ Feingold, Dennis Kucinich, just a handful, our voices were not represented. Your thoughts, please.
Well, to build on what Danny's been saying, which I completely agree with, we have never had more offensive television ads and more money poured into them or less useful substantive coverage in between the television ads. And I was on a non-U.S. station, Al Jazeera, today, sitting next to a guy from a corporate front AstroTurf group called FreedomWorks, and they played us, these racist ads that Sharon Engel, Senate candidate in Nevada, has been putting out, treating any Hispanic as a criminal and a plague that's invading the nation, and asked this gentleman sitting next to me what he thought of that, and he sort of quoted Donald Rumsfeld from when Baghdad was being looted and we were guarding the oil ministry, and said, well, freedom is messy, democracy is messy, and I had to say, wait a minute. We're part of democracy, too. We have an obligation to denounce such ads, to vote against anybody who airs such poisonous filth, and to work to change the system so that our politics is not decided by auction to who can pay for the propagandists who come up with the most emotional and manipulative advertisements and air them with the greatest frequency. We have to create a system where we have free media time on our airwaves for ballot qualified candidates, and we have to create a system where we have decent news coverage in between the advertisements, including through publicly funded media and community funded media that actually serves a small d democratic purpose in this country, or we're in deep trouble, because currently the news absolutely omits any issue on which the two parties agree. So the wars aren't part of the election. Corporate power isn't part of the election. This unprecedented avalanche of corporate money into the election isn't a story, because neither party wants to talk about it. And so you'll hear tomorrow, Tea Party, Tea Party, Tea Party. You'll never hear the phrase Citizens United, which is the ruling in the Supreme Court in January, which flooded all of this corporate money into these elections. And so the media is very much at the heart of what ails us.
Final question for you, David. How in the world could we possibly consider ourselves any longer a legitimate democracy when the Supreme Court ruled that corporations, even countries, could have the same power as a citizen and do so in the most oblique manner, and we don't know who then is buying the access to the candidates and the lobbyists, and we do not know what their ultimate agenda is. It's all done in secret. What kind of democracy is that?
Well, the incredible secrecy of our government is a serious problem, and the claims of the current administration in the White House far exceed any of their predecessors in terms of what can get into court and what can be released to the public. But in terms of the corporate funding, you know, if there is any fight over it in this coming lame duck session, it will be over, you know, whether we get to know the names of the donors or not. But whether we do or not, the problem will be there. And we know essentially that the money is coming from a very, very wealthy people and corporations, a tiny sliver of our population, and international corporations, and we know what interests, what corporate and industry interests are involved. So, you know, even if we got to know exactly which corporation gave which money, the ads would be just about as effective, and we would still have a very, very sick system. Whether you want to call it a legitimate democracy, I think it's very much in doubt. When there was a study a couple of weeks ago of nations around the world in ranking them in terms of the rule of law, and we ranked very, very low, and we had the benefit of ranking pretty high in the subcategory of not giving bribes to our elected officials, for the obvious reason that we've institutionalized bribery and made it legal and don't call it bribes in this country. So I think, you know, we never had a direct democracy where we have public initiatives that they are manipulated by corporate money as well. But we really don't have a representative republic. And if we want to, we have to get rid of the money. We have to have a communication system, and we have to make it possible for ordinary people to run for office and to be represented. And, you know, that's an agenda that there are people within this so-called Tea Party movement that can get behind with us. You know, we all think the government is broken. We all want these serious reforms. And these are people who are going to be very disappointed in 2 years, just as Democrats were very disappointed right now. And so the question is, can we build a movement now, independent of the Democratic Party, that perhaps is even open to some people who have been misguidedly backing the Republican Party? And can we push for the necessary changes at the local and state level to fix this mess before it gets beyond the point of no return?
I agree. Thank you very much, David Swanson. Some very good insights. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Great show, as always.
Let's now go over and say hello. We have Glenn Ford. We have Bill Thompson. And coming up in a few moments, we will have Christiane Brown. Nice to have you with us today, Glenn Ford.
Oh, good evening. Or rather, it's not a very good evening.
No, it's not. I gave a long introduction to you earlier in the program. I would like your perspective on what's missing in American politics today. What's missing in the coverage tonight of these different campaigns, the left, the right, and the Tea Party? Give us your perspective, please.
Well, clearly what's missing in American politics today is a social movement. We were sold a bill of goods, and that bill of goods came as much from the left as elsewhere, that the election of Barack Obama was itself a movement. It was not. It was an election. And it was an election in which white folks only voted for Barack Obama in the 43%. It should have been expected that there was going to be a white nationalist backlash to the actual reality of having a black president in many districts in the Deep South, but elsewhere. Obama only got single digit or low teens votes from white people. So the whole idea that there was some great national transformation that occurred, something that was irreversible, was part of that bill of goods as well. It should have been expected, and we fully expected it, Black Agenda Report, that white nationalists would regroup after their shock of 2008. We couldn't have necessarily predicted that the Koch brothers would lend their millions of dollars to further energize that reactive group. We could have, I guess, predicted that Rupert Murdoch would have lent his entire communications apparatus to firing up that group. What we do know is that in United States elections, these are contests between minorities, and the energized and mobilized minority wins, and especially in congressional elections. We should have expected when the economic collapse occurred, or the fear of economic collapse occurred in 2008, that in a fundamentally racist society, there would be a scapegoating of non-whites, that would be the response of a whole bunch of white Americans, and that could not be overcome politically unless there was some countervailing extraordinary call from the presidential bully pulpit for some kind of project of national social cohesion, a larger mission. And sometimes those larger missions can be war. At one point in our history, that larger mission was to rebuild America through massive jobs and public works programs. But clearly, that national mission was not to bail out the banks, a project in which Barack Obama was just as much involved as his Republican predecessors. Clearly, it was not a health care project that wound up making everybody pay for private health insurance. So there was going to be this powerful backlash unless there was a unifying frontlash, if you will, in the form of this national cohering project. I think that is the actual background for this election.
I appreciate your input. When I look at this, I don't see a person of color. And if it was a woman, I wouldn't see a gender issue. I see, what does the person who is given the responsibility, a president, a senator, a House member, a Supreme Court justice, a governor, a state representative, a mayor, a city council member, at the end of the day, these are all individuals who have an agenda. Whether we're told and shown what that agenda is at the outset of the process so we can then align or challenge it is part of the issue. And in the case of the Republicans, in the case of the Democrats, in the case of Obama, in the case of Bush, less so in the case of Bush, his was very self-evident, but in the case of Clinton, Clinton did more to cause the economic juggernaut that we're in today than any other politician. Ronald Reagan didn't have the political power to do it, but Bill Clinton with his group, and those were all Democrats with the exception of Phil Graham, who at one time it was a Democrat, gave us the Glass-Steagall Act destroyed the Glass-Steagall Act and the Future Commodities Trading Act, which allowed Wall Street to come in, and Wall Street doesn't care. You can be white, black, yellow, it doesn't matter. It's green that counts on Wall Street. It's green that counts in corporate America. It is the color of money and what money can buy you. And if money can buy a politician, or if money can buy a newspaper or a Murdoch institution that supports them and they can control it. If money can buy a Supreme Court, whatever it takes, they will buy it. The trouble is the person you're talking about, the persons that I'm talking about, average citizens, no matter what their background, common citizens, middle class, working class, poor class, these are the ones that are only looked upon as commodities. So at the end of the day, if a person is of real character, they will set aside the racial issues and say whatever programs we have, they must benefit all Americans. We're not going to exclude them because they're a minority. We're not going to exclude them because they're a majority. They must be fair and moral. But when was the last time we voted for someone because of their spiritual values? They're humanistic values. In fact, the moment you mention spiritual and humanistic in the same word, same sentence, you're excluded because you're one of those secular humanists. You're not a value. And therefore, now what we have is a body politic that calls itself religious but lacking spirituality, calls itself pragmatic but lacks insight and nuance, calls itself practical, but has caused the problem, and both left or right, they're going to continue to grow the government, but not parts of the government that benefit the average person. Not with the social programs you referred to from the great social programs under either Lyndon Johnson or under Kennedy or even under Franklin Roosevelt. They're going to create bigger corporate subsidies, less rules and regulations to live by, crisis of oil rigs blowing up. There are 27,000 there that are decommissioned rigs, and no one's going out to see if they're safe. They control, and I think one of the reasons that they control is because they've made the issues divisive on racial levels, on ethnic levels, and now we have to look at the reality. We are dealing in a class warfare that is both class and racist in the United States, and if we're not honest about it, then we will be hung by our own petard. Closing thoughts for you, Glenn.
Well, of course, nobody would deny, certainly I wouldn't, that we have a dictatorship of capital here. But the way that capital in the United States historically maintains its mass base is through race. The Republican Party has for a generation been the white man's party. It certainly could was logical and to be expected that it would try to make its comeback by appeals to race, and that's how we see this this volatility that's personified or by the Tea Party. What we're really worried about here is that Obama, now in a far worse position, more unfavorable position than in his first 2 years, will still continue to attempt to create a kind of grand coalition with the GOP. This is what he did when he had majorities in both houses. If he tries to do that again, then we will be in a far worse position as progressives than we were during his first two years. I think that the best we can hope for is that there is a kind of gridlock, that the Republicans do try to overreach, that whatever reaching across the aisle Obama does, and it seems to be his pattern to do that, is rejected by the Republicans, and they cancel each other out. And at least we won't, because he still will retain the veto. Bad things can only happen here if Obama collaborates in those bad things happening.
I very much appreciate your input, Glenn. Thank you very much. And Glenn Ford can be heard on Black Agenda Report Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network, one of our top 10 most popular programs. Thank you very much, Glenn, for being with
Thanks
us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You know, one thing we rarely think about is why do we assume that Barack Obama has been misguided, that he's been misled, that he's surrounded himself with bad people, wrong people? Why do you assume any of this? I can assure you, just like Bill Clinton, he will have a very prosperous future. in a moment. We are going over and say hello to, we have two more panelists left, Christiane Brown, and she's been broadcasting for over 20 years. And she produced and hosted The Solution Zone daily on Air America and also on the Nova M radio networks and KGFK AM out of Reno. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Into our final segment we go, and let's say hello now to Christiane Brown. Nice to have you with us today.
It's so nice to be with you, Gary. I've really been enjoying listening to all of the discussion that you've had this evening. It's refreshing to hear this kind of discussion on election night.
Would you share now with us your overview? I'm going to give you the forum. I don't want to interrupt you. You have a lot to say, and I want you to take your time and lay out your arguments. And we have an audience, by the way, worldwide tonight, and they'll also be downloading it because it's not just for tonight. These are things to think about in the future as well. But lay out all of the points that you believe we need to be focusing our attention on. The forum is yours.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Gary. You know, the crux of the conversation that I've heard tonight, and it keeps going back to information, misinformation, and inability to pull aside the veil to open up people's eyes so that they understand about the global economy, understand who's calling the shots, who's running the show here in the United States of America and throughout the world. And because people don't seem to have the kind of access to this information that they need, the kind of political system that we now have in the United States has been made possible. I was thinking about it today in Nevada. I am in Nevada, where this huge race is going on between, amazingly, Sharon Angle and, you know, even more amazingly, Harry Reid. But this is going on. And as I was going over to vote, you know, I thought about it. This is really just the illusion of choice. This is, you know, a show that is put on to make people feel, some of them, that they are somehow participating in a democracy that's really been taken away from them in so many different ways. And it doesn't matter whether Harry Reid wins or Sharon Angle wins. I mean, many say it matters a great deal. If you look at what is going to change in the long run in terms of corporate control of every aspect of our government and every aspect of the things that are important to us, including, as you were talking about earlier, the kinds of food we eat, the kinds of health care that we have, the way that we discuss vaccinations, the truths that come out are completely locked up and controlled by a corporate voice that dominates everything else. And so I think the gist of it is money and corporate money.
And power. What does money give you? Money gives you power. Exactly. And why would an individual need power over another person? Because they're insecure. And how do we ever know the depth of a person's insecurity? Because in some rare moment, we see by their actions or their statements who they really are. But until that moment, we are living the myth of each person's persona played out in the public arena, but with terrible consequences. If we had a spiritual person or a true progressive like Ralph Nader, if we had voted for Ralph Nader, we would not be in Afghanistan. We wouldn't be in Iraq. We would not have the Patriot Act. We would not have had the evisceration of the habeas corpus. We would not have Monsanto just about ready to take over our entire food production. We would not have a failed healthcare system because we would have been looking at strengthening the rules and information on what causes our disease, including our diet. But instead, the very things we need to hear, we exclude from any of our media discussions, and that is part of the problem. Your thoughts, please.
Absolutely. I think about this recipe that's been created. You know, you watch shows like the, quote, liberal MSNBC, Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, and the, quote, you know, conservative Fox News. But if you look at the range of debate between both sides. It's very narrow. It's just a tiny narrow margin, tit for tat, back and forth, which allows the major issues to be completely ignored. And yet the average viewer, again, the misinformed viewer, will watch that and say, oh, these must be the important issues that are up for debate. We need to debate whether or not Michelle Obama spent a lot on her vacation instead of whether or not we're spending $1 million per year per soldier in Afghanistan, which is really what the problem is, one of the main problems with the economy, not that somebody gets to go on a more expensive vacation than I do, but it's a simpler idea, and I feel that we're always lowering the bar. You know, I just got back from England. Actually, I was in Europe last week where my brother works as a journalist for Bloomberg, and I was talking to him about Barack Obama, and he said, well, you know, Barack Obama really needs to simplify things even more for the people. He's too complex, and he's still talking to people in such a complex way that they can't understand him. And I asked him this question, and I'd love to get your idea on this. I said, don't you think, though, that that's part of the danger, that we're continually dumbing down the audience, that we're continually lowering the bar in terms of what people are expected to understand in order to make a decision? And don't you see a danger in that? And he said no, but I'm curious about your thought.
I stopped appearing on Good Morning New York with Regis Philbin after I was on every week for a year. I was the nutritionist invited on. And I told the producer one day, I'm sorry, I can't be on here anymore. And he said, why not? I said, well, by the time Regis does his intro and asks the questions rhetorically and I have a chance to make a statement, my 3.5 minutes are up. There was a time 20 years before then when if I went on a show, I would at least be given 10 minutes. I said, when someone comes on my radio program, I give them at least 20 minutes, as much as an hour, with few interruptions. And he said, but that's not the media. And I said, no, that's what you've created. And then a person's expectation is, if something's longer than 3.5 minutes, I'll lose my focus. And I said, you create the very thing you complain about. You say people have no attention span, but you don't do things in such a way to give them context. Americans today lack context. We lack scholarship. We lack the desire to even know the true story, and we never want to see a story that challenges our belief systems. And the belief system is our reality. So if your belief system tells you that we must cut government without looking at what we're cutting, and then you see that you were manipulated, you've honored your belief system, but you have not honored authentic change. And I said the reason I didn't vote for Barack Obama or support him, I simply took 1 hour and I found every single bill he had ever voted on, where he got his money, and how he then supported lobbying for King Coal. It was Barack Obama, when he was a lawyer and also a professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago, that he supported the coal mining industries taking the tops off mountains in Appalachia, my home area. So when he would become president, do you think he's going to do a about-face? No. He then went further and promoted the oxymoron of clean coal. And so all I did was look at where it came from to know where it was going. And why Americans refuse to engage in scholarship is because we refuse to spend quality time on anything, and we will never do anything from changing our diet to changing our mind if it creates discomfort.
And it also seems that we've been given permission to be stupid.
Yes, we have.
Really, it's okay. You know, George Bush is a perfect example of the, well, I don't pretend to be a learned man, but I'm going to weigh in on this anyway. And then the boxes on television that put up, I was watching an interview with Al Gore, and the woman who's married to Alan Greenspan, I'm trying to remember her name, the reporter who's married to Alan Greenspan, was talking to Al Gore about climate change. And she said, well, Sarah Palin says this about climate change, as if this is some source, you know. And I wanted to say, well, my gardener says this,
yeah.
About it's amazing, because the illusion is that if you can put somebody on television, they are instantly an authority on an issue, and people accept that. If somebody tells them this person should weigh in on it, that they never ask, well, how are they qualified? What do they know about the issue? As long as their face is on TV, they're somehow in a similar position to weigh in. It's amazing, but it's the way people's minds have, as you said, been trained.
I would also have challenged Al Gore. I did a whole commentary today on Al Gore's actual voting record, how he did not intercede to stop or even make a public issue of the genocide in Rwanda, as neither did the two Clintons, but had a choice and chance to and didn't. How he helped take down the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, open up old wood forests for exploitation, opened up mining in areas where it would have caused leaching of uranium in Montana and Wyoming. And I went through all the things he supported. Did you know that Al Gore voted to take away, as a senator, take away the welfare program for poor children, lunch programs for poor children? All the things you would never imagine someone who was running as a Democrat to have done, and yet all someone had to do is look at his record. And that is what bothered me, that even Bill Maher, and I thought Bill Maher made a terrible mistake when he got down on his hands and knees with Michael Moore and begged Ralph Nader not to run. And I'm thinking, are you aware that Ralph Nader caused more positive change, legislative change, 271 separate laws to protect our environment, to create the EPA, to all the things he did? And what have any of the people like Al Gore done to support that? Look at what the man has done. Look at what he stands for. And then
exactly. But see, it's the maintenance of the cocoon. You know, we can only step out this far in a lot of people in terms of, you know, we want Al Gore to win because we think he has a better chance of winning than Ralph Nader. Not what has Ralph Nader done as opposed to what Al Gore has done. No, we want the cocoon of winning and losing, because that's what the news networks are telling us. It's fascinating when you look at just the campaign between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, when they started to tell us that they were the front runners, and actually based it on how much money they had, and said, you know, this person has this much money, this person has that much money, and therefore they're the only people in the United States who have a chance to win this election. Just qualifying it like that was an amazing thing for me to watch, and that's fine. That's accepted that, if you have the most money, that's your chance to win in America, and nobody pausing to say, and how wrong is that, and isn't that the crux of the problem, and are we looking at a millionaires club here, and who is running for office, the people or the corporations that support them, and are they one and the same?
I've been very disillusioned, Christiane, with the Democrats who did not owe up to the fact that they were really corporate shills. PBS, I've produced and been on PBS with 26 separate specials. And one of them in particular, when I was on in Washington, D.C., after the presentation, which was very successful in raising funds for him, the program director came over and said, great job, we're going to re-air the show 8 times more. But an hour later, before I was leaving the station, he came over to me and he said, I'm sorry, I can't have you back on again, and we won't be able to air this anymore. I said, why not? He said, well, Sharon Rockefeller called. She's the president of our local board, and said, don't have him back on again. I said, well, why? Well, because she's on the board of Pepsi-Cola, and you just criticize how much sugar the average children's consuming, and the Sugar Institute called her, she called me. And I said, but you're supposed to be public television, not corporate shill television. And at the same time that that was happening, Henry Kravitz, and I'm sure you know who he is, the biggest buyout king, a corporate raider, equity partnership deal, was the president of PBS in New York, Channel 13. And all across the country, I could show you who is sitting on the board. And these are all so-called nice Democrats. No, these are corporate shills, and they vet what goes on. And if they don't like your message, no matter how important your message may be to the station and its audience, you don't get on.
And well, this my is show true got across drowned the board. Out. I'm sorry to jump in. My show here in Nevada, even though we, quote, turned Nevada blue and, you know, I had a large listening audience here, was drowned out because I was saying what wasn't palatable for both either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I was just trying to tell the truth, and that was not popular, not considered to be something that the station felt that they could support because of the same reasons. You know, I wouldn't have people on my program who were advertisers for the station because I didn't see that that was really forwarding a message. And, you know, I wasn't allowed to do that. You really are put in a position of having to fight for the truth in this society if you do not have the level of funding that now is required, you know, to get to a mass audience.
You're absolutely right. Just a little caveat. This year I was the keynote speaker for Equinox Earth Day at the United Nations. And after we had the ceremony and rang the bell and went over to the discussion, and I hear all these heads of all these environmental organizations in front of me, my opening statement was the biggest problem with the environmental movement today are the heads of the environmental movement. And then I went on to talk about how big money from energy cartels had corrupted the message and the movement. And the moment big dollars came, and I gave examples, $7 million, $15 million going to different organizations, they no longer found a problem with the oil, no longer found a problem with gas fracking, no longer found a problem with nuclear. And I said, so look in the mirror tomorrow and ask yourself, how much compromise are you willing to do in the name of your own economic survival, instead of holding some standard to really protect the environment? I thought I was going to get booed out of the room because they were not expecting this talk. It's up there. You can see it.
Right.
But I would like for journalists, I would love to see a journalist talk about how corrupt the American media, left and right, has become because it is beholden to ratings or beholden to advertisers or beholden to rigid ideological boundaries, and I'm glad that you're one of those people who have not compromised. We're out of time for this segment. Thank you very much, Kristan.
Great to be with you.
And her program is on Mondays at 7 p.m., and it is called The Solution Zone.
Actually, Thursdays.
Oh, you changed it. Okay.
Thursdays, yeah, it's changed Thursdays at 3 p.m.
Oh, great. Okay.
Eastern Pacific.
Thursday at 3 p.m., The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And finally, we're going to go over, and by the way, I will take some calls. I'm going to hold my line open. We'll probably go a little past 8 o'clock, and we're going to have you a chance. You've been listening now for 2 hours. What are your thoughts? What would you like to share? I'm sure that when you've been listening, you've had ideas. I'd like to hear your ideas. Call us at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I always like to leave time for people in the audience who have something to say, say it. But let's go over now and say hello to Bill Thompson, also doing a program here on the Progressive Radio Network on Thursday. It's Thursdays at 7, Bill?
That's correct. Thursdays at 7.
Bill, you've been listening here tonight. Give us your input on the issues that you see are important and your perspective.
I'm a little bit more commercial and crass. I respect, you know how much I respect everything that you do and the other people that were on tonight. I tend to look at things a bit more mercenary. I tend to follow the Mark Twain school that says that no one ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of an American. I am rather calloused by what I see. And I hear the blaming of the corporations, and I don't find that to be accurate. I blame the people. If the top 10 cable television programs, five of the top 10 are either wrestling or fighting, something of that. This is the intelligence of the people that are out there that are making decisions. So I get rather unimpressed with people who blame corporations when all the corporations are doing, which is their job, is to make a profit for their shareholders, and they do that by looking at their audience, looking at their customers for what their customers want. Now, if a customer had an IQ, the customer would not have a television. The customer would have books in their home, would have discussions, would be involved with the debate things like you're talking about here. They would pay attention carefully to what these politicos are saying, and they would make a stand on what they feel is important. And I'm tired of hearing the Tea Party getting this blame as if they're some kind of low-life redneck racists, because this is not accurate either. They are people whom are angry with the way that they have been treated. And will they do anything about it? I doubt it. Will they get co-opted by the Republicans? I think so. I'm sorry to say, but that doesn't mean in their heart they aren't good. That doesn't mean in their heart they aren't some kind of problem people, because they're not. But I really think that if you want to improve the country, the world, da-da-da, you're going to have to look at yourself first and stop blaming somebody else for the problems that you're having. That's my two cents.
All right. Let's just look at that for a moment. People do not live in isolation, even if they're lonely. Even if they're not connected at the social level, we are all affected by the media. The difference is your ability to differentiate the media that is constructive and the media that is manipulative and destructive, both radio, television, print, magazines. And at some point, I agree, you must stop blaming the world outside of yourself and say, I'm the one who chose the pizza. I'm the one who chose to use pesticides. I'm the one who chose not to argue against the war in Iraq. I'm the one who chose not to care about the homeless people in America or the home foreclosures, or to ask the president, why can't you just sign an executive order and stop this madness? You're giving back the homes to the people who caused these people to lose their homes, and you bailed out the people who caused these people to lose their homes, but you've not helped the people stay in their homes. Is there something that I'm missing here?
You chose to turn on Fox News and have that as your only source of information. Don't come to me and cry that you don't know what's going on because you have one source.
All right. I also believe that more Americans who are awakening, and there are first going to go through a process of anger, of having simply been in denial. I don't believe most Americans are stupid. I believe we act stupid. I can't tell you how many smart people have done stupid things and good people have done bad things because they did not have either the intellectual, creative, or spiritual discipline to honor the mindfulness of their own moment. They were allowing themselves to drift into this reactive subconscious tape library, which has, for the average person over 40, has over 600 million tapes in your subconscious, and simply hit a tape that defined your reality for you. I said recently that most people's biggest problem in life is not the job, that is important, however, or their relationship, or their age, or state of health. Those are all important. But more important is understanding the myths of their story. And we all have stories. And more often than not, we begin to rely upon our story in all of our communications and all of our efforts, until one day we don't even challenge whether or not our story is at all wrong or right. We're living by the myths in our story. Therefore, we don't see the impact we have upon the children in Iraq. And that really became glaringly important to me when I saw that Al Gore was not concerned about 500,000 children who had been victims of our sanctions in Iraq under Bill Clinton. And then Madeleine Albright went on Leslie Stahl's segment of 60 Minutes and said she was not concerned, that she didn't feel that it was that important. And I'm thinking, well, it's not important to you because your child is not one of the 500,000 children who are dying because of our sanctions. And then it occurred to me, how could she be so cold and calloused? How could all these people be so indifferent? And then I just understood, because they're living through myth, not reality. It's no different than a rich person looks down from their skyscraper and says, see all those little people down there? I'm disconnected from them. They have no
third man.
Yeah, they have no significance in my life. Since when? What if you're one of those people on the street looking up and say, friend, could you help me?
Right.
But no one listens to you. I think that we're, as a nation, we have been sliced and diced into so many subsections and so many categories that we begin to believe that we are that much different from one another. And I don't believe we're different at all, because I happen to be that person that has counseled over 1,000 of the 76,000 people. I've counseled 1,000 of some of the wealthiest people, investment bankers, celebrities. And if you're sitting across from where I'm at, you just see an individual no different than anyone else.
I agree with that.
And no brighter than anyone else. And I'm tired of people putting themselves down, thinking, I couldn't run for government, I couldn't hold an office, I could. And I'm saying, why do you say that? I could teach anybody in less than a month how to be president of the United States or governor or any other office.
That would give them 30 days more training than they already have.
None of these people are that bright. But we all like to think that somehow they are the anointed ones, and they alone have the secrets. It was 12 years ago, I was walking on the beach near Santa Monica with the Nobel Prize winner, Terry Mullis. He discovered the PCR in chemistry. And he was being filmed for my documentary on AIDS. And he was one of the very first scientists to say that HIV had never been isolated and couldn't cause anything, but other causes were the real cause of AIDS. Now, mind you, this is an interesting man, and he wrote about it, and he stopped me. Right, we were walking, and I had a camera guy walking beside us, and he stopped. And he said, Gary, he said, do you realize how many people think or believe that somewhere in America there is this group of wise men and wise women who do nothing each day but solve problems for them? There are no groups of wise men and women working together to make it a better world for all of us. They're individuals, but no group, and certainly not in the body politic. And I was thinking about that. How many people are under this illusion that they don't have to worry about the problems? Someone else will solve the mess that is made, whether it's when they become sick from their diet or their environment is so polluted. And then you take a look. People moving right on an earthquake fault in the L.A. area. People moving where there's a forest that's dry as a bone up in Flagstaff and Sedona and Arizona. People who are living in the hurricane areas. People living in the tornado areas. As if somehow there will not be a consequence to their choices.
Well, the nuclear power plant in Southern California is not built next to, but right on top of the San Andreas Fault.
Yeah. Well, Bill, final thoughts from you, please.
I think that people need to stop looking outward and look inward. As you had pointed out, look at your own self. Determine what you can do. I asked you one time when I was very confused about some poor people on the street there, and I said, Gary, I feel so weak that there's nothing I can do for these people. And you held up your index finger and you said to me, Bill, don't worry about it. Help one person today. That's all you can be expected to do. And that changed my life. I stopped looking at the huge, horrible problems and decided to look at how I interact with it. And I took your advice, and I'm helping everywhere I can, one person a day, and suddenly I feel so much better about myself, and I do thank you for that.
Bill Thompson, whose program is on Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you. Bye.
And we're going to close out our program with some final thoughts from Danny Schechter. Danny?
Well, you know, Gary, for what it's worth, people have to know this. The House has fallen to the Republicans now. The Senate is still in Democratic hands, but by a very tiny, fragile minority. Cuomo won the governorship of New York. Palladino went down in defeat. At the same time, what is this really going to change in our realities in America? You listen to what you've been saying tonight, the deeper issues that face all of us, I think we'll be unaffected by this whole political transformation, at least initially. I think we're going to move into an area of stalemate and even more paralysis in Washington. It seems like, you know, the choices that we've had, the candidates that were selected, in a sense, for us to vote on, are cut from the same, you know, cloth, no vision, no real deeper analysis, and a media basically that panders to the public. So our challenge, you know, as individuals remains to try to investigate what's going on ourselves, to try to get at the truth, to try to tune into outlets like Progressive Radio Network and the website, and, you know, to try to get exposed to the information that's missing in the rest of the media. And I think if we do that, we're going to feel a lot more powerful as individuals, in the same way that Bill felt empowered to be helping one person. I think we have to help ourselves too, and arm ourselves with information or harm ourselves without it. And that's why I'm really excited that, you know, PRN has taken this initiative to do this special tonight. Hopefully we'll have more specials, you know, in the future, where we take an issue and look at it from different angles. And I think you've done a great job tonight in doing that, Gary.
Thank you very much, Danny Schechter. Danny Schechter is the news dissector, and you can hear him on the Progressive Radio Network. His show airs Thursday morning at 10 a.m. and Friday following my program at, excuse me, Danny's show airs Friday at 1 o'clock right here on the Progressive Radio Network. We will be doing other program, other specials and upcoming issues. Please let us know what you think. You can go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, the fastest growing internet radio station in the world. I look forward to sharing more with you. Thank you all very much. Have a good evening.
Many a tear have to fall.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.
You have